step by step.
Welcome, everyone, to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group's Town Hall version of the Thursday night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. I'm going to invite Megan up here to have our joke now.
Hi, I'm Megan. I'm an alcoholic. Okay, so a man walks into a bar and asks the bartender for a drink. As the bartender pours the drink, the bowl of peanuts suddenly exclaims, "An excellent choice on the beer, a really fantastic decision." Thinking he is hearing things, the man heads to the bathroom to splash his face. On the way there, the jukebox yells at him, "A beer? Horrible choice. The only thing worse than a beer is that ridiculous excuse for a shirt that you're wearing." Startled, the man rushes into the bathroom to wash his face with cold water. When he's done, he returns to the bar. As the bartender brings back his beer, the man says to him, "I think I'm going crazy. I thought I heard the peanuts calling out praise, but then the jukebox shouted abuse at me. Did I imagine that?" The bartender shook his head. No, sir. My apologies. The peanuts are complimentary, but the jukebox is out of order.
Nice. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Barry. Thank you, everyone, for braving the elements and joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation, so please take a moment to get situated. Turn off all devices that will make noise and distract others. Take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the day drift away and ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. Is everybody ready?
Thank you.
All right, we are now going to go ahead and go with the fog light prayer. It's not up here right now, but it should be in a bookmark in front of you if you can find one. God, let your love shine through me. There's a solution from the Big Book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked Carissa to come up and read Spiritual Experience. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 chapters is to help us. It's kind of important to know what one is.
Hey, my name's Carissa and I'm an alcoholic. Spiritual experience. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in the book, which upon carefully reading shows that the personality changed significantly to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifest itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readings to impression that these personalities changes or religion experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Sorry, I'm nervous. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is enormous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. It was not our intention to create such an impression. Many alcoholics have nonetheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an intimate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations through frequent are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the William James calls the educational variety. Because they develop slowly over a period of time, quite often friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that of the difference, he has undergo a profound alternation in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by that himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few expectations, our members find that they have tapped an unexpected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most empathetically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honesty facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Albert Spencer, Alcoholics Anonymous, pages 567, 568.
Thank you, Carissa. Please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. This is a tech-free meeting, so turn the phones off. We're all lucky to be here for Pat's fifth session. It's been eye-opening and really hit home what he's spoken about so far. So thanks, everyone, for joining us. Please help me in welcoming Pat.
I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Pat. Thanks to the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the program of AA, I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and for that, I'll be forever grateful. AA didn't just save my life, but it gave me one worth living, and I absolutely love my life today. For the most part, I really enjoy myself, and where I really enjoy myself is here. And you said it. I mean, how lucky we are. You know, how lucky we are to be here. I often wonder why I'm spared and others aren't. You know, and I was a little down on the way here last week. By the way, I apologize if I sounded a little off last week. I didn't feel good last week, so I feel a lot better tonight. But last week, after last week's meeting, two of my guys went out, you know. So I don't know how good a meeting I did last week. Didn't seem to land with those two, you know. And we know that's not our fault. We know that, right? Anybody that works with other people knows that. And the one rule that I go by, and I tell everybody this, that a successful 12-step calls when I don't drink, right? And that's the truth. That's the way this thing works. We were judged by results, we'd all be in trouble, right? I mean, we're not in the results business. We're in the carry the message business, you know. But what's baffling, right, is what's baffling is on the outside, they seem like they wanted it so bad. You know, I mean, it's just this desire. And I believe that desire was sincere. I really do. I believe that everybody gets up here and walks up here for that white chip and, you know, everybody surrenders. I think they really mean it at that time. That window often doesn't stay open very long. But I believe they really want it. Not that they even really want it. They really need it. I mean, they're like me, man. We suffer from a severe case of this shit. You know, it's like, I mean, I got a bad case of alcoholism, man. I really do. And look, it's not about drinking and drugging. It's about alcoholism. You know what I mean? It's about what goes on up here. And what goes on up here is what causes me to drink. And that's what we're going to talk a lot about tonight. It's drinking was not my problem. Drinking was my solution. And they suffer from the same solution. And I mean that. They suffer from the same solution, you know, because that solution eventually led to the bedevilments on page 52, you know, where my solution stopped working. And their solution's not working too good either, but suddenly, right, I love that line in the book, right? Because isn't that how it happens, right? Like, suddenly, I got an idea, you know? And both of them, I mean, the one committed, like, totally. Like, I said, this is it. Like, yes, I'm in. I'll see you Tuesday night. And, you know, and I said to Randy, I said earlier, I said, we heard no more from Fred for a while. That's big book code, by the way. He relapsed. You know, when you read that line about Fred, we heard no more from Fred for a while. Fred's on a run. That's why. And so we heard no more from this guy for a while. And the other guy, we had dinner together at the Floridian, right? We hugged it out at 10 o'clock. I'm going to drop this off and I'm going to go back. And ain't seen him since. You know, because suddenly, you know, it's just amazing. This it is cunning, baffling, and powerful. This is a powerful sickness, man. It really is, and it even baffles me at times. And I tell you, I wish I was bulletproof, but these guys, a lot of them, and anybody that does a lot of sponsorship knows that some of them, they get a piece of your heart, you know, and when they go out, they take a piece, you know, and it. You feel it, you know, and I feel it. I do, because I know they're the hopeless variety, and I'm so blessed. We're so blessed to be here. I mean, I really feel like when we talk about chosen, I just feel like I'm chosen. My one of my mentors, Ben T. He used to say that when you walk through that archway on the third step, you know, it says freedom on the outside, and when you get out, when you walk through the arch and you look back, it says chosen. You know, and I, that's the guy, the ones who are around here were chosen. Now, I'm not telling you I don't work for this thing, because I do. I chase it. I do. I still chase it. You know, I've been around a while and I chase it just like I did when I got here. I do. you know, I'm not for everybody. I'm in. I'm like all in or all out. I mean, that's always been the way it is, you know, and it may have cost me some relationships in recovery. I mean, that's just the way it happens. But I have to do what I do to maintain what I have. And that's, and those guys, I believe, and the guys like them and the guys like me need to do the same thing. I really believe that. I don't think you can, you know, well, I'm going to do 3 meetings a week and, you know, I'm going to do my Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or Saturday, and, you know, I'm going to spend the other 4 days, you know, doing whatever and finding that B word, you know, that elusive B word, you know, that balance thing, you know. And I don't know. I didn't know about balance when I was out there, and I don't know about balance in here much. I mean, I know that there's work and relationship and AA going on, but I want to tell you something. I think I would guess that AA is still 80% of my life. I would guess if I was going to put a percentage on it all. But I'm blessed. You know, we'll talk a little about relationships. I'm blessed to have somebody that's in as deep as I am when it comes to recovery. You know, that works this thing as hard as I do, and so I'm lucky that way. I get to walk this thing with somebody who's walking the same walk, and that's the beautiful thing. So, you know, we're gonna. And you know and tonight's where the work starts. I mean, this is where the recovery program starts. Is in 4. We're going to talk about 4 tonight. I hope we're going to talk about 4 tonight. hasn't started off well, but you know, so far there's a lot of. A lot of information handed to us in the first 3 steps, and you know, we've got the doctor's opinion and 4 chapters on the first 2 steps, you know, and then we hit chapter 5. We have, you know, 4 chapters in the doctor's opinion on 2 steps, because at the end of how it works, it says being convinced, you know, and they're doing all they can to get us convinced, we're at step 3, and then, you know, they spend almost half a chapter on step 3, half a chapter 5 on step 3. I think this thing's falling. Here we go. I got it. I got a resentment about this thing right here. So, you know, being convinced, and that's, I keep harping on this, I keep saying it probably every meeting I'm at, you know, there's no requirement for membership in AA, but there's requirements for a spiritual experience. There's a requirement for recovery, and 3 of them are steps 1, 2, and 3. You know, I mean, but 1 and 2 especially. You know, William James is where Bill got that, facing an insurmountable obstacle. You know, and then admitting that the only solution is a deity of some sort, a power greater than human power. That's a requirement. Because there's no reason to move forward from there. So we make a decision to seek that power, and that's the first 3 steps. And so far, it's just 2 conclusions and a decision. There hasn't been any work, unless you want to count getting on your knees with your sponsor or, you know, taking that action, which, by the way, is humbling, and it probably your first move towards God, towards our fellows, and towards recovery. I mean, that's humbling, you know, for sure. It's a kind of an omission, bend your knees, bend your will, you know, that's kind of the deal. And so there's some, you know, the 12 and 12 talks about action in the 3rd step. You know, the big book doesn't, it talks about a decision, but the 12 and 12 expands on that a little bit. And so I'm not going to get into that camp, which whether it's an action or not, but I know that it, so far we haven't done anything to treat our alcoholism. that I know. We've become aware that our problem is that we're selfish and we're self-centered and we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, and we step on the toes of our fellows in the need to satisfy my instinctual drives, the need to try to fill a hole with attention and material security and emotional security and sex, and a need to fill this void in my life, I step on the toes of everybody around me. I create conflict everywhere I go because there's just not enough of anything to make me happy for any period of time. I mean, I do get brief moments of it. You know, I get brief moments of joy, like I talked about last week. You know, I get brief moments from people telling me, oh, you were great, or, you know, oh, nice job, you know, or or being part of, people let me in, you know, let me be part of. It was funny. I told that story. I don't know if I did tell that story, but anyways, I was talking last week about the need for attention, right? And that I've lied. I didn't tell you last week, but I used to tell for years that I saw Eric Clapton, you know, because somebody said once they saw Eric. We were sitting at a table and somebody said, I saw Eric Clapton. And I said, yeah, me too. And I never saw Eric Clapton, you know, but I don't know why I said that, because I wanted to be part of. And they went, really? And they said, where? And I made up a couple lies. You know, I said, yeah, it was in Pittsburgh. When? 1973. You know, where? Three Rivers Stadium. You know, I had this whole, and I want to tell you something. I told that lie for so long that I believed it. I really did. I mean, I told you, I started to expand on the story and tell you then what he was wearing, and there was he was so drunk that there was a couch on the stage. I had this whole story to go with it. And they went, oh, and it really held people's attention, and they really loved the story. And so did I. But I loved the attention. And I told him I saw Pink Floyd too. You know, they said, did you see Pink Floyd? I said, did you? He said, yeah. I said, yeah, me too. You know. By the way, I did finally see Eric Clapton 5 years ago. I have witnesses that saw me there. I'll tell you what's something funny about that story is that 2 weeks ago, I'm doing a step series in Crossroads. 2 weeks ago, I tell that story. Well, 2 weeks ago, this woman came up to me after I told the story a bunch of weeks ago and gave me a 1969 copy of an Eric Clapton album, you know. And then last night, gave me the phonograph to go with it, you know, to play it. So it was worth telling that story. But here's the thing, right? We laugh about that, right? And I tell that story just to give you one example, right? So I leave here last Thursday night. Friday, I'm talking to somebody at one of the Fraction resorts that we go to on Friday night, right? And somebody says, do you know, they were talking to me about recovery and people who do step series in the big book. And he goes, you know Bob? And I'm not going to say his last name, but he said, do you know Bob? And I said, I don't think I know Bob. And he says, yeah, Bob, Big Book Bob. And he says, you know, everybody knows Big Book Bob. Oh, no, Big Book Bob. Yeah, I know Big Book. I don't know who fucking Big Book Bob is. But why do I have to know who Big Book Bob is, right? I mean, you'd think 28 years later I'd have this thing down, you know, where I wouldn't care what you think about me. You know, and I tell you that, by the way, I tell you when somebody says, you know what so-and-so said about you. And I said, I don't give a shit what he thinks about me. But the truth is, all I care about is what you think about me. And that's just the way that is. I don't know why. It's just because I get satisfaction out of being liked and accepted. That's just the deal. And it's temporary, of course, because, you know, it doesn't last very long. You know, so got to make up a new lie. But people eventually find you out, you know, and then they retaliate. They back away from you. You know, they find out you're a liar. And by the way, you can tell the truth a million times and tell one lie, and guess what you are? You're a liar. You're not a guy who tells the truth all the time, but yeah, once in a while he lies. No, you're a liar, you know. You could cheat once. You know what you are? You're a cheater. You know, that's just the way that goes. You know, that's the labels that go on you. But back to where I was going. So I was talking about the attention and the material the goods, you know, buying the new car, buying the new watch, you know, having somebody depend on me, because that's what we really want. I mean, most, you know, Elkie love is codependency is what it is. You know, that's Elkie love. I mean, you know, a lot of people call it stalking, but we call it Elkie love, you know, and that's just, you know, that need to have somebody to make me happy, to fill that damn hole, you know, and the same with the sex. You know, there's this huge relief, there's this, you know, beautiful experience attached to that, but I can't get enough of it. You know, it's so fleeting. You know, I get this great joy and then I need to do it again. And my life has been made up. We'll talk a lot about this when we get to 6 and 7, because by the way, I think everything's leading there and I think everything leads back there. You know, I think it's all about these instinctual drives. This whole program is about reeling that in. So I've perverted these instinctual drives for pleasure to a point where I offend everybody, including myself. And my former sponsor used to say that alcohol would give me permission to satisfy these instinctual drives beyond what God intended them to be, and then afterwards get absolution. And I've absolutely just destroyed relationships for brief moments of pleasure, just destroyed relationships. And so I think the fourth step, moving into the fourth step, is an effort to find the truth in that. You know, is that true? Am I really selfish and self-centered, driven by fear? You know, is there a truth in that? And to me, that's the idea of the fourth step. And I want to touch on one thing before I move into four, and that is why so many people hesitate. Why? I mean, I didn't know any better. I did not know it was a scary thing. You know, nobody told me that, you know, because that's what you hear in the rooms. They almost, the people in the rooms with time almost discourage the newcomers from doing the damn four step. Like, wait till you get to your four step, you know, or they raise their hand, I'm on my four step, I need to share, you know. It's just that kind of, I mean, that's just not true. It's just not a list of dirty, nasty things we've done. It's not an attempt to reflect on what we've done bad in our past. It's an effort to find the truth. Bill uses the business example to drive that home, that analogy that he uses, fact-finding and fact-facing. The step says searching and fearless, right? And that's it, fact-finding, fact-facing, searching and fearless. And the beauty of the business inventory says in an effort to find the truth. Right, and I think we see that word moral. Oh, this had an experience. Anybody else? but I think we see that word moral, and we think it's that we think he means amoral or immoral, and that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about moral. He's talking about the truth. Bill was a literature major, by the way. He knew the English language. He would have said immoral or amoral if he wanted us to write a list of nasty things we did. That's not what he's looking for. That's not what we're looking for here. It's an effort to find the truth about ourselves, right? And I think if you're like me, does anybody like read a page and not know what they just read? Right? Am I the only one that does that? Like, you know, butterfly, you know, and then I could read a chapter and somebody would ask me what I just read and I would have no clue what I just read. Because, like, right now, there's another conversation going on up here. You know what I mean? Like, I'm reading, but my mind is in somewhere else, you know. And I think a lot of people read this thing alone, read that book alone, and there's one paragraph that explains the fourth step. One freaking paragraph gives you all the instructions on the fourth step. And if you miss that, if you read past that, you're going into later on, you get to the fifth step, and we say we tell our life story, and that's what we think we're supposed to do. And by the way, some sponsors have their people do that, write their life stories. And I'm not going to, you know, I think that's something to do down the road maybe. You know, timelines, life stories, that kind of stuff is great. But that's not what we're trying to accomplish here, you know. We see that in the fifth step. We tell our life story, and that's what we think we're supposed to write, so we torture our sponsor with a life story, you know. Did I say that? I'll tell you what your life story does. 95% of it has nothing to do with your alcoholism, but it conveniently covers up the 5% that has everything to do with your alcoholism. You know, that's what that does. It becomes a long, drawn-out story that covers up everything that has anything to do with your alcoholism. This is about specifics. This is getting down to the nitty gritty. This is the directions are clear cut. I mean, it's really and by the way, the timeline is next and at once. Just in case anybody's wondering, right? We get on our knees if we do our sponsor. We do the third step with our knees. You don't have to get on your knees to do it, but you do your third step. And then it says next and at once, right? It doesn't say wait a year. It doesn't say wait till you feel better. You know, you get better doing the fourth step. That's how you get better. You don't wait till you're better to do the fourth step. Now, I get it if somebody's detoxing and they're still not clear. I get it. You know, maybe you need to hold off a little bit. But I'm telling you, that book has a specific timeline, and it's next. You know, and unless we get down to causes and conditions, that third step will mean nothing. That decision to seek God will mean nothing, because Harry Thibault says in the back of the book, he talks about the amazing recuperative power of the human ego. And eventually you're sitting here long enough and you go, you know, I think I overreacted. You know, I don't think I really need this, you know. It's like, do you ever take somebody to detox? And as soon as you get them in there, they go, I don't know. I may have overreacted here, you know. They're willing to do anything until you get them in the front door, right? But that alcohol is but a symptom of underlying issues, and we got to get to those issues. We got to get to why I drink. The conversation is going to switch, right? We went from mental and physical in the first two steps. Last week, we talked about behavior, didn't we? Third step talked about behavior, that it's my need for pleasure in every area of my life that is the problem. I've got this hole in the soul that I'm trying to fill with other stuff, you know, and there's no chemical or material solution for that hole in the soul. It just isn't, it's just not going to happen. And we're, what Bill says, that we are suffering from a spiritual sickness. Actually, he uses the word spiritual disease, right? Probably time you'll see the word disease in the book, right? Because we don't care about the disease concept of alcoholism. We don't care why we're alcoholics. We just want to know how to get over it, right? We'll let the medical fraternity decide whether it's a disease or not. We don't care. We really don't. But he's talking about some, this conversation went mental, physical, behavioral, and now spiritual, right? That the need to satisfy these instinctual drives have created a spiritual disease. And unless we overcome this spiritual malady, he uses the word malady meaning sickness, unless we overcome this spiritual sickness, this soul sickness is what he's talking about, you know, then we'll never recover mentally and physically, right? That's scary, right? That tells you that 1, 2, and 3 will not keep you sober. That's what that tells you. That unless you do something about what's going on inside us, unless I do something about the way I feel, then I'm not going to be able to hold my breath very long. And that's what it becomes about, right? Anybody that's relapsed and tried to do this thing, not drinking and going to meetings and 1, 2, 3 out, they know that feeling. What it's like to hold your breath. You know, how long can I hold out? How long can I feel the way I'm feeling before I explode? You know, how long can I cover up this feeling with something else before it's just not enough? And I know that feeling. And I've suffered there in sobriety, by the way. I've been there in recovery. You know, it's alcoholism. It's not about the alcohol and drugs anymore. You know, Sandy Beach says, my favorite line from, one of my favorite lines from him is, you know what happens when you stop drinking and drugging? You're freaking sober. Right? My solution's gone, right? I don't feel, you know what? Charlie Palmer used to say it, you know, he said, yeah, you'll feel better when you get here. You'll feel anger better. You'll feel resentment better, right? You'll feel fear way better. You know, yeah, that's what I felt when I came here. And in about 90 days, I couldn't hold my breath anymore. And I let you guys have it, and thank God somebody was there and heard untreated alcoholism come out of my mouth and grabbed me and said, look, you better start writing. You know, you got to get busy here. And that's exactly what I did. You know, I wasn't afraid of the four step because I didn't know better. I didn't know it was a scary thing. And somebody took me word for word through the book and showed me the specific directions. I wasn't handed the Hazleton format. And not there's anything wrong with that. But if, I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's got like 1,000 personality traits that you're supposed to attach to every behavior. You know, maybe it works down the road, you know. But this is like specific, right? We get down, we make a list. Resentment's the number one offender, right? This selfishness is manifested into a spiritual sickness, as Bill calling it, and the spiritual sickness is manifesting itself in three forms: resentment, fear, and guilt, remorse, and shame. Right? And those are the three major forms. He's going to use these core issues that he's going to focus on. Resentment and anger being the number one offender. Right, destroys more alcoholics than anyone else, and I think we get that. You know, I think resentment definitely the number one offender. Resentment and anger, you know, and we're all familiar with that. You know, to refeel comes from the word centauri. You know, to put a re in front of it means to refeel, to feel again. You know, and we do that. I mean, people hurt us. I mean, people do things to aggravate us, to make us angry, or to hurt us. And by the way, real or imagined. Right, the book says that real or imagined. Remember, I said by the way, my third step is for me that my thinking doesn't go directly to an action. My thinking goes to an emotion, and that emotion is dictated by what I think you just said, or how I think you just meant what you said. or how I perceive what you think you said and meant, you know, and then I take an action based on that emotion, right? And that's the way resentment works, you know, and sometimes it's not even real. I was sitting there doing a step series at the 101, and I'm talking, and I thought it was one of my finest talks, you know, and I'm like about three quarters of the way through the talk, and there's three girls sitting at the table in front of me, and I know them because, you know, they were in a program, and all three of them got up and left, right? Now, I don't give a shit what they think of me. But all I could think about, while I'm talking, there's the other conversation going on, like, what the hell did I just say, right? Now, the other 100 stayed. But these three bitches got up and left, you know? How rude is that? Like, if you're going to get up and leave, sit in the back, you know? Don't sit right in front of me and get up and leave and make me look like an asshole. But I don't care what they think about me. I'm pissed. I'm still talking, but inside I'm burning up. I'm like, this is bullshit right here, you know, like, and I know you know them. And so I leave the meeting and I'm going over to meet my wife at the resort. And I get there, and the whole time I'm there, I'm going, if I ever see these, I'm going to tell them how rude that is, because I'm taught, I was taught etiquette in AA. When the speaker's speaking, you don't get up. You wear a collar. At the, you know, I got ethics. I got AA ethics. And so I'm all the way over there. I'm thinking about, if I see these bitches, I'm going to tell them. And I get there, and all three of them are there to see their friend pick up her one-year medallion. What an ass, right? It's always about me, and then it's always about me. It's always about us, right? Like the two guys that are talking in the back of the room, I know they're talking about me, you know, and what I just said. And that's imagined crap. I mean, that's not real, but it steals my emotions. It doesn't just rob me of time. You know, if that was all it took was time, all right. You know, the book talks about it steals time, you know, but what it steals is my emotions. You know, I let it steal my emotions. I let it take me. It really makes me sick. Like a soul sickness, like a physically sick. I mean, I physically feel sick when I'm resentful. And, you know, unless we overcome it. I was sitting in a meeting one night in my home group, and one of the, you know, look, I got AA ethics, right? So you shouldn't crosstalk during the meeting. You shouldn't talk during the meeting. Try to be quiet. If you're going to talk, take it outside. And here I am talking to my sponsee while the speaker's speaking, and some old guy shushed me. Son of a bitch. In front of the whole meeting, shh. I'm like, holy shit, did he just shush me? In front of my guys, embarrassed the hell out of me. Everybody turns and looks, you know, like. I don't hear another word. I don't even know what was said after that. I don't know what this. Anybody do that? Like, something gets, like, you didn't hear a word the speaker said. Like, if somebody asked me his name, I didn't know. I didn't know what it was, you know. I didn't hear a damn word. I got outside and somebody said, what's up with you? And I said, you hear that guy tell me, shut up? Now, he shushed me. He didn't say shut up, but that's what I heard, right? I heard shut up, right? He said, did he really say shut? Yeah, he said, shut the fuck up. That's what he said to me. But that's the way I tell the story, and that's what we do, right? As we tell the story, we embellish it a little bit because I want to look like a victim. I want really what I want from you is self-pity. I got it. You know, hey, I'd leave that group. I think I'm going to find another home group. But some bullshit right there to be treated like that in my own home group, you know. Who needs them anyway? And there's where the slip starts, by the way, right there. That's where the slip starts, right there, when you start disconnecting from your home group, right? You start disconnecting from the people that you've been chasing. You know, you start. I told the Tony Bocelli and Mark Brumel story the first week I was here, and anybody wasn't here, I'm not telling it again. But you got to find your Tony Bocelli. You got to find your Mark Brumel. And I had those guys in my home group. I hung with those guys. I want to know where they're at. You know, if I can't find a speaker, I want to know where they're at, because I chase them guys. And now I'm deciding whether I want to disconnect from them or not. You know, and I'm disconnecting from my lifeline. That's what you're doing when you disconnect from this fellowship, right? Yeah, is this all about God? Or is this all about the fellowship? Or is this all about service? I'm not playing that game. It's about all three. It's about all three. And sometimes I need you because I can't connect with God. And sometimes I've got a channel. It seems like I have an open channel there and I'm fine. And sometimes I need my sponsees. You know, I need to call them and ask them how they're doing. They think I'm checking on them. You know, I'm a mess. I just want to get out of my head. That's all I want to do. So how's it going? You working on that four step? They keep you on track, them guys, right? I was sitting with one of my guys. I said to him, tonight, I want you to do a nightly inventory from here on in. I says, you know what? That's what we do now that you've been through the steps. You can start. I'm going to send you the format, and you fill it out, and you send it to me every night. And he says, do you do it? And I went, of course I do. I started that night. I hadn't been doing it for a while. But that's what happens. That's why you sponsor guys, right? Because you can't tell them to do something you're not doing, especially if they call you on it. You know? They might want proof. You know, just a side note, resentment being the number one offender, right? Just a side note is that that's why you can't do relationships early in recovery. You know, that's just the deal. I mean, nothing causes resentments like relationships. And I don't even think they're intentional. They just do. You know, we say stuff sometimes that we don't realize is hurtful, but it is. And, you know, and sometimes it's just the way I perceive it. You know, I walk out, and I remember walking out, and Shannon looked at what I was wearing and said, you're really wearing that? I went, Jesus, you know, like, what the hell? I mean, why are you so mean? I mean, why, you know, I mean, but that it was nothing. It was it probably didn't look good, you know, but I'm thinking, why would somebody tell me not to wear that, you know? So the next night I wore one of my favorite shirts, and I told her how many people complimented me on that shirt. Got three compliments last night on my shirt. And she says, yeah, it looked good. I wouldn't have wore it with those pants, but, you know. But you're just—it's just going to happen. The thing is, I don't drink over them. You know, I don't drink over them. I get over them. You know, it takes me a couple days sometimes. You know, but you know, 3 or 4 days later, I'm fine. You know what I mean? So I lost a week. What's the big deal? You know, but I don't drink over them, and that's not true early in recovery. You know, and we're so dependent, and what we're doing is we're really medicating early in recovery rather than work the steps. Let me get her in a relationship. That'll make me happy, right? Because that's what we thought all our lives it was going to make us happy, right? If I could just get the right job, make enough money, get the right car, get the girl, I'll be happy, right? I mean, my whole life was an ego-driven life, all my life. You know, it was never spiritually driven. We're trying to flip that. And you come in here and new, and what you want to do is medicate with a guy or a girl, you know? And they just don't last. I mean, you can't help yourself. Alky love, it's alky love, right? It's stalking, right? I mean, and now with social media, it's brutal, right? I mean, you can follow them on social media. Like, you know, you tell them you love them in the morning and they don't react, you know, like they don't love you back, you know, or you like their posts and they don't like yours, you know, but then they like somebody else's post, you know, and then you're like, what the hell? They liked his post, but not my post. Maybe she's seeing him, you know? I wonder if they're friends. Let me see if they're friends, you know? It's like, Jesus, you know? Probably having a relationship with the guy. That's probably what's going on here. It's great, right? It's an addiction, right? I mean, the phones are insane, right? I mean, you can't. I know half of you are just dying because it's humming on your ass and you want to look at it. You know somebody just liked one of your posts and you got to see it, you know? We start bragging about it. Look at this, 80 likes, you know. we're too fragile. We're just too fragile for it, right? Newcomer relationships are this. My life is unmanageable, and I want to share it with you. That's what it is, right? Two flakes making a blizzard, man. That's what it is. And it actually kills. I mean, look, get your feet under you. Get a foundation under you. Get the steps in your life. Get some recovery in your life. I'm not anti-relationships in AA. I am blessed. Two people walk in the spiritual path together, there's nothing more beautiful than that. There is nothing more beautiful. I get to do that. So I am not anti-relationships when it comes to AA. I'm just, don't do it early. Don't do it early. It's hard enough to have healthy relationships when you've got recovery under your belt. Don't do it. You know, don't medicate. Get clear. And so it's the mechanics of the force. Where am I at here? We don't have a clock, huh? Yeah. So the mechanics are this, right? We made a list of resentments. A list, by definition, is top to bottom, right? We're looking to inventory. An inventory, by definition, is a list of items, right? So we list our resentments top to bottom. Who am I resentful for? We don't want to go left to right like we normally would. We don't want to relive the event. We want to inventory the event, right? The events. So who am I resentful at, right? Number one on my list was wife, right? Number two was ex-wife, right? Number three was current wife, right? By the way, all the same person. The IRS, the police department, her attorney, right? I mean, it's people, institutions, and principals, right? It's halfway houses, right? The court systems, you know? You just make the list. Why am I angry? Yeah. She took the house. She had me arrested, you know? She put a restraining order on me. She took custody of my son, you know? The police arrested me. The IRS, they took my money. You know, my father was on that list. You know, left when I was 5. Beat my mother. You know, that kind of stuff. I mean, just brief and specific. We're going to tell the story later in step 5. Now it's just inventory. And then the next question is this, and we're going to talk a lot about this in these 12 weeks. What part of myself was affected? What instinctual drive was affected? Because that's what's important. Did it affect my social instinct? What people think about me or what I think about myself, my self-esteem? Right? Did it affect my security instinct, my possessions, or my emotional security? Or did it affect my sex instinct? And what we find is that's all that mattered. It didn't matter who did what. It was how I was affected. Anyone could have done it, and I would have been affected the same way. The person kind of becomes insignificant, and even what they did kind of becomes insignificant. What becomes significant is how I was affected. And you start to see that maybe I had something to do with this resentment. Just maybe, right? The police, they arrested me. What was affected? Well, obviously, my social instinct. My neighbors saw me arrested. My children saw me arrested. My self-esteem was affected. Yeah. With my material possessions, I lost the house over it. Got a restraining order. Couldn't sleep in my own bed. Affect my sex instinct. Damn right, I wasn't getting any after that. Yeah. The IRS didn't affect me much socially. Definitely affected my material instinct. Just finding out the truth, right? Fact-finding and fact-facing. My father left when I was 5. You know, beat my mother. Well, I was affected. My social, every instinctual drive was affected there. I was affected socially, didn't have the support that I probably should have had as a child. You know, my self-esteem was affected because of that lack of support. You know, our financial, material possession, my security instinct was affected because there was no child support coming from him. There was, my mother was on welfare trying to raise 4 kids, working nights. You know, affect my sex instinct, only in the future. Because we see later, looking back in the rearview mirror, that my relationship with him had everything to do with a lot of the failures of my future relationships. Yeah. But I only see that in the rearview mirror. Yeah. So we get down to the facts. We're learning the truth. And something becomes really apparent, and that is that in all of these instances, I'm the only common denominator, right? Like, you know when you have, like, 5 relationships listed and you're the only common denominator in all 5? You know what I mean? Like, you have resentment towards 5 different women. Like if you've had 5 jobs, it's not the job. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you've had 5 failed relationships, it's not the relationships. It's you. You're the only common denominator in all of them. You start to see a pattern, and most of them just drop off. I mean, most of them immediately you see, you know, yeah, the IRS, I should have paid them. you know. Yeah, she had the police arrested me. Yeah, they were called to the scene, you know. It wasn't like, let's go arrest Pat Knight, you know what I mean? It was somebody dialed 911 and called the police. They were doing their job, right? My wife had me arrested. She was assaulted. Right? She took the house. Yeah, she was trying to protect her children and keep a roof over their head. Yeah. Wanted a divorce. Yeah, who wouldn't? You know, who wouldn't after I put her through what she, what I put, it becomes really apparent. 95% of them drop off right away. I mean, just, they just start to disappear. 5% don't. I couldn't let go of the fact that I was losing that house, that I lost custody of my son. You know, that was killing me. I am that house. Do you know what I mean? Did I tell you the ice cream truck story? The ice cream truck story is a great story. And I heard it early in recovery. This guy buys an ice cream truck. And let's call him John, right? And you see John, he's driving his new ice cream truck. Say, John, how's the ice cream truck going? Oh, business is great. You know, sold all kind of ice cream today. A couple days later, you see John. You say, hey, John, how's the ice cream? He says, ah, freaking truck. You know, truck broke down and sell shit today. You know? I don't know what's going to, I don't know if this business is going to work for me. See him a couple days later. John, how's that ice cream truck? Yeah, I got the truck fixed. How you doing today? He says, oh, the ice cream truck, got the truck fixed. Seems like we're back on track again. I'm selling ice cream. John became the ice cream truck. He is the ice cream truck. Never said how he was feeling, never said how he was doing. It's all about the ice cream truck. I am the ice cream truck. I am the house. You know, that house is all I am. That was my identity right there. Without that house, I am nothing. Without that car, I am nothing. Without custody of my son, I am nothing. Those things validate me. And without validation, I feel like nothing. And I couldn't let that go. I just could not let it go. I remember Dennis O, who was one of my mentors early on, but really he was a disruptor. You know what I mean? Do you have people like that in your life where they just disrupt you? You know? Like, their job is to disrupt you. That's what it is. Their job is not to comfort the discomforted. Their job is, if you're comfortable, they want to make you uncomfortable, right? And Dennis would say stuff like, "You, what's going on?" He said, "How you doing?" I said, "Oh, Dennis, man, it looks like I'm gonna lose the house. That I can't believe she's taking my house. In the meantime, the house is in my name, Dennis. I mean, it's my house, you know." And he said, "You're really worried about that house, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you're gonna lose it." Now, I don't know how you guys know this stuff. You know, I don't know where you come up with that kind of bullshit. And that's what I said to him. What the? How can you say something like, "What do you know? What do you know?" Right. About 3 weeks later, I saw Dennis, and he says, "What about that? What's going on with that house?" Dennis used to greet you like this: "Hey, tough guy. How's your way working for you? How's that? What's up with that house?" And I said, "Ah, Dennis, I don't care about that house anymore. Screw that house. It's just, you know, I don't give a crap about that house." And he says, "You know what? You're going to keep it." You know, I don't know where they come up with this stuff, right? But I want to tell you something. 28 years later, I'm still in that house. Right? It's amazing. She didn't even want the house. She only wanted the house because I wanted the house, right? She couldn't afford the house. Dennis would say stuff like, "Yeah, go get that house. Kick your kids out of their bedrooms. Yeah, go do it. You're a tough guy. Go kick your children out of their bedroom. Yeah. Take your house back. It's yours. You know." God, it just make you feel like, just disrupt you. You know what I mean? Just disrupt you. And then I walk away like this. I go, "What do you mean by that? You know, what did he mean by that? You know, confusing, very confusing." But I couldn't let that go. I wanted it. I worked all my life for that. That's what I felt. I felt like I worked all my life for that, you know, So we get a tool. We get an amazing tool, and to me, this is where the essence of the spiritual experience starts, right here. In the fourth step, I believe the first major personality change starts right here, and that is we learn to pray for those people that we dislike. That is amazing. I would have never thought of that. First off, I would have never thought of self-examination to begin with, but to pray for people that I dislike or that I hate is an amazing tool. I would have never imagined that would work. And they said, "You need to pray for her." And I go, "I didn't pray for her." You know, said, no, you need to pray for her. And I said, no. And somebody pointed me to the story in the back of the book called Freedom from Bondage. And said, you need to read that story. And I went to the back of the book and I saw it was written by a woman. I said, nope, I'm not reading it. No, this is slanted. This is slant. This is propaganda right here. Once again, trying to trick me. But I ended up being in enough pain to read the story. And what the story, the short version of the story, is that you pray for people that you dislike or that you're resentful towards for 2 weeks straight, and you pray for them to have everything that you would want to make you happy. And you pray for their happiness, you pray for their well-being, even if you don't mean it. Even if it's only words, and you don't mean a word of it, you pray for them anyway. Damn. And mine started out like this: give her everything she deserves, God. You know, that was my first prayer. That was the best I could muster up at the beginning. You know? But I want to tell you what happens. As you pray for them, and it starts to settle down, and I want to pray for her to be happy, kind of, you know. And then what dawns on me, and look, this is God stuff, and this is unexplainable stuff. This is on a different level. This is God's economy here, right? When you start praying for somebody, the God in you connects with the God in them. The brokenness in me connects with the brokenness in them. And all of a sudden, you're on the same level, and you're just two broken people trying to do life the best you can. And all of a sudden, you're praying for their welfare, and it dawns on me. This is a spiritual awakening. It dawns on me, why would I want the mother of my children to be miserable? Why would I want that? That doesn't come from me. That comes from above. That comes wherever that the universe, however that works. By the way, I'm not real clear on that, but you know, I'm part of. We're all part of this universe. I think we're all connected. You know, but where does that come from? The truth hits me smack in the face. How about your children? And I start praying for her to be happy because I want my children to be happy, right? And the truth is, I start to mean it, and I really want her to be happy. And that's an amazing gift to be able to find solace on. You start to see, you start to say stuff like this: I wonder if I could be helpful. Right? Can you imagine? I hated this person a week ago, and now I'm wondering if I could be helpful. I wonder if she has enough money. Yeah, I wonder what causes her to be like, oh, it was me. It was probably me. You know, it was probably my influence on her over these last 12 years probably is why she is the way she is. But you start really wondering what makes up people, right? I mean, and you start looking at their childhood. I start looking at the way she was raised and abused as a child. And I start to understand what's going on in her life. And you start to deal with all people like that. You start to see miserable people as sick rather than out to get you. Right? And you start wondering, I wonder what's going on in her life to make them so miserable. I wonder if I can help. That's different. We're sitting at Bonefish Max one night. Remember, the waitress comes over and just slams the menus on the table and walks away. I go, Jesus, the hell is up like that? Like, it was you. But, you know, but the old me, and we're talking about, like, when I was talking about spiritual experience last week, that old me would have been, hey, where's the manager? I'm a customer here. I'm not supposed to be treated like that. And I look at Shannon and I go, dang, I wonder what's up with her, you know? And she came back and we said, and I said to her, are you all right? And she said, no. She said, it's been a day. And I said, sit down. And she sat at the table with us. Right? That's not me. That is not me. That's something on another level, right? That comes from that's a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. I'm no longer resentful and angry at this person. I wonder how we can be helpful. And we got the best service we've ever had from a waitress from then on in. Told us about her day. You know, this is the way my day's gone. Right? We become a different force. Right, I'm a big frequency guy. I'm all about what you put out there is what you get back. You know, you put negative frequency out there, you get. I'm a big Rhonda Burns fan. The Secret. I read The Secret every day, man. That's my thing. I love that. You know, and it's all about we are one universe. We are all connected. We are all connected. And if I can put a positive frequency out there, I'm going to get positive back. And I can bring out the best in people, or I can bring out the worst in people, depending on my attitude and my outlook on life, or just how I meet you, how I greet you. When you come to the door, I meet about 5 to 8 different people a day. And if I'm standing in that door wondering what the hell is taking you so long to get to the freaking door, and you get there and I got that look on my face like, huh, you know, I just brought out the worst in them, because that frequency is going to continue and that relationship's not going to go well. But if I stick my hand out and I introduce myself and say, hey, you know, I'm here to do whatever, how are you? And they introduce themselves, stick their hand out, and that relationship goes positive from then on in. That's to me, the first major spiritual awakening that takes place in this book right there. Prayer. Using prayer as a tool. And it's a ticket to freedom. You no longer dictate how I feel. You no longer steal time from me. I have lost years, not just hours and days. I resented dead people, for God's sake. You know, they're gone, right? They're over it, right? People have moved on. I mean, I don't even know where some of the people are that I'm resentful towards. I was resentful of my father until I took this attitude and started to look into his childhood. And man, the more I looked into his childhood, I said, this guy had no shot. He had no shot at being a parent. He had no shot at a healthy relationship. He was raised by two raging alcoholics. His dad used to wake them up and have them compete with each other, fight each other for entertainment. How is this guy going to have a healthy relationship with my mother or a healthy relationship with children? Had no shot. No shot. And you start to understand. Now, I don't condone the behavior. I don't own that behavior, by the way, but I own the resentment. You know, I own the resentment. And we'll talk more about the step four next week. Thanks for letting me be here. Mm-hmm.
You know, whether you're working through, reworking through, or taking someone else through the steps, it's such a critical component of this overall process. And that was an inspirational, transparent, honest, and authentic message. So let's thank Pat again. Now, if she's here, is Tanisha here? It's going to be Ryan. Lucky us. Ryan for our secretary's report.
In keeping with the seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. And I've asked Alex to read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering, and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic.
Alex, recovered alcoholic. Recovered. We are not cured from alcoholism. Recovered but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for a lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than the body. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
...1940s-style Big Book sponsorship from forward to the second edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experienced is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back into his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. Can I see a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? Awesome. And then is there anybody in the room that needs a sponsor? If you could raise your hand. No. Oh, we got someone right here. Can you stand up real quick? No? Can you stand up real quick? So if anybody can meet up with her after the meeting, well, let's get her back to God. Please join us Monday nights for our Big Book study meeting. It's actually right in this room. And it's where the Big Book comes alive. Fellowship starts at 6:30, and the Big Book study starts at 7:15. And then we have CDs, mugs, large print Big Books, little red books, and Big Book dictionaries for sale right up on the rack up here. We meet every Thursday starting promptly at 7:15, and we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells. And also, we have a 75-foot no-smoking radius. What is that called? I don't know. distance up from the door. So when you get outside the doors, if you go to the left, there's a bunch of buckets set up. So just take it down there. They have, like, play practice and stuff downstairs, so there's lots of church people around, so we don't want to be those people. So that's what I've got for this week. We don't have any announcements because there's no... I don't have any jokes. I'm sorry. But all right, that's all. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ryan. As Pat mentioned, you know, when you read something and it doesn't settle in right away, and it takes a couple of times for everything. We do have these podcasts available online, so if you want to go back and listen to the message again, please do. Also, as Ryan mentioned, Monday nights in this room, we have our big book study. Just finished the doctor's opinion, so a very cool portion of the book that we're about to go over. Those who wish to thank Pat tonight, please line up down the center aisle, and let's close with the Lord's Prayer. If we earnestly seek him, who will bring us from shame to grace?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us.
All Monday.
Heart is heavy, soul is thirsty, body is aching. I am desperately in need of restoration. These possessions that I have amount to nothing at all, and I am willing to hand over every one of them, 'cause they won't profit me. Can't get it right.
promise can't get you right. It doesn't matter how hard I try, but with you I become a much stronger man. Getting on my knees puts me back on my feet again. On my own, I just can't get it right. It doesn't matter how hard I try, but with you I become a much stronger man.
Michael Chase, here's that song you've been asking me for a million years. I finally pulled it out the corners of my mind, and here you go. Fog is lifted. See the light, count my blessings when I go to sleep at night, and I dream now. Fear has left me and I'm standing tall. A pile of bricks now lies where once there stood a wall that I hid behind. For all this time, sometimes it takes a burning bush or a great white light to set you right. Well, my eyes don't cry now, and I'm out to dry. Pity party's over, the guest of honor has arrived, and he's on my side. For the first time in my life, are green now, growing vines. They twist and turn each way, flowers blooming all the time right outside my door. But never before I had to change everything to realize that today is the best day of my life. Broken man, I travel far and wide through the great divide, through his own heart, yeah. Well, I have a life today when it give away, and it's just about to start. Brand new way, show up and plug in my guitar, and I play my songs, and people sing along, and stomp their feet and raise their arms, and here in this moment that we share, nothing could come in. Lessons when I go to sleep at night, and I dream now. Yeah, I dream now, and everything's alright. Oh man, going on 10 years old that song is. God bless. I love you, Mike Chase. Bye.
shine a light on me tonight.
On your way.